And we've been going through the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, and we're on volume 4 now, following in the Buddha's footsteps. And that book talks about refuge, and then as part of explaining the Dharma refuge, then it explains the three higher trainings in ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. So we're on the section now on the four mindfulnesses, in particular the mindfulness of wisdom. The three higher trainings, and we're on the higher training of wisdom. Okay. So the part in the book where we're afraid, where we are, you can tell we're a ways along in it. But I think everybody should be able to get something out of this talk, because we'll be talking about the mindfulness of breathing. And I assume, hopefully correctly, that you're all breathing. And, so you can apply this to your breath and to your life. Okay, for those who are following the book, we're on page 341. Okay, so we always begin by taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. So when we take refuge, it's not to empty space, but instead we visualize the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the space in front of us, ourselves surrounded by all sentient beings. And all the sentient beings want happiness, but they don't know what the cause of happiness is. So we think that we're leading them in taking refuge so they can learn the Buddha's teachings, and in generating bodhicitta so that they will have that aspiration for full awakening. So we'll start off with that and some chanting that goes with it, then a few minutes of silent meditation, and then I'll lead you through cultivating a motivation. Okay. So take a minute and imagine yourself sitting in the presence of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So I'll generate our motivation. So we usually feel like we are separate individual beings, unrelated to anything else. There's me. And we sometimes broaden it to include mine or my. And then we look at other people in terms of how they relate to us, because grasping at this independent self, what follows is we want happiness, we want pleasure. So we look outside to our environment and which people can give us pleasure, what objects can make us happy, what policies or beliefs do we think are the best. And so the world, other people, the objects around us, all become seen in terms of how they relate to the self, to the I. And if you don't think that's true, then when you wake up in the morning, observe what your first thing is, what your first thought is, what you go to first. And it usually centers on the self and what can bring us happiness. So with attachment to all of that, then we also become disappointed when the pleasure isn't what we thought it would be or should be. We become angry when someone or something interferes with our happiness or takes something that we are attached to that we want. And then other times we just abide in a very confused state, looking here, looking there for something to amuse ourselves with. So that too, that confusion centers on the I. What do I want to do? What do I feel like eating? I don't know. What do I really believe? Let's see. I don't know. So we're in a state where we can't discriminate what causes happiness, what causes suffering, not even in a worldly sense, let alone in a Dharma sense. When we look at this from a Dharma sense, then virtue is what causes happiness. Non-virtue causes misery. And yet we want to be happy. We're not quite sure what is virtue, what is non-virtue. And then we're not quite sure if we want to practice virtue and abandon non-virtue. So there's a lot we need to clarify in our mind to accurately see our situation. And this is where the Buddhist teachings come in. So the four truths, the three higher trainings, wisdom and compassion. And it's not only us that abides in this state of confusion, decorated with attachment and anger and jealousy and pride. It's everybody else who wants happiness and to avoid suffering as intensely as we do. And like us, they're very confused about this. But we're fortunate in the sense that we've met the Buddha Dharma and we've started to learn what causes happiness, what causes misery. We've started to learn how to subdue our attachment and our anger and clarify the ignorance. So when we practice, seeing that all other sentient beings are in the same situation as we are, let's practice for the benefit of everybody with the aim of ourselves developing the wisdom, compassion, skillful means, and all the qualities of a fully awakened Buddha, so that we will have the ability to be of the greatest benefit to all other living beings and to help them on the path so that they can have the real happiness that comes from Dharma practice. Let's make that our motivation for sharing the Dharma this evening. Sometimes when we hear the idea of attaining awakening for the welfare of all sentient beings, we want to qualify that a little bit. All is too many. Okay. I want to attain awakening for my own benefit. So you're going to look at everybody else and say, okay, ciao, good luck. We can't do that. That's why the Buddha taught the four immeasurables. That's why he taught the four Brahmaviharas. That's why he taught bodhicitta. Yeah. So it's to really broaden our mind, and whatever living being we look at, no matter what they look like, what our relationship is, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, that's the big thing now, to categorize people. None of that really matters when you think that everybody wants happiness and nobody wants suffering. And especially when we add on to that, that we are the recipient of tremendous benefit from others. Yeah. Everybody have a good lunch today? Yeah. Do you know who planted the food that you ate? Or the people who harvested it? People who transported it or packaged it, the people in the grocery store, helped you with the checkout, the people who made the shopping baskets that you put your food in. You ever thought of that? Who made those shopping baskets? Where did the metal come from? Who had the brilliant idea to have a little seat in front for kids? When we look at all of this, it becomes so evident that we're the recipient of tremendous kindness from others, and that we are not independent, isolated beings. We live in relationship to every single being. Well, somebody says, but, the famous words, what about if I go and I live in a cave up in the mountains? How are you going to get food? You're not going to hunt for it. Maybe it's snowy. Somebody's going to be bringing you food, offering you food. Who made the path that you walk on to get to your cave? And tell me that there's absolutely no other living beings nearby. Not even spiders in the snow. Some spiders live in the snow, let alone bigger animals. And just because you live in a cave somewhere doesn't mean you don't live in relationship to everybody else, because we live in a universe where we are in relationship to all other living beings. It's impossible not to be. Because if you say, I'm not in relation to sentient beings, that means you are, because you can't make that statement without there being sentient beings, and you're pushing against them. Okay. So we need to really accept that and see the kindness and how we could not stay alive just on our own. Impossible. Yeah. So with that, you know, when we start now, we're going to be going through the mindfulness of breathing, you know. Really think that I'm doing this for the benefit of all beings. You may be watching your own breath, but you're doing it for the benefit of sentient beings. Okay. This morning, you asked Geshe-la how to keep your bodhicitta motivation active when you're in the middle of chopping vegetables, sweeping the floor, doing some kind of task that you have to focus on. Because if you don't focus on it, you might make a mess. Yeah, or you might hurt yourself. Okay? So there's this thing where you can have one state of mind that is being held by another state of mind. Okay? So we generate bodhicitta. That is our motivation. We can't, you know, focus on the kindness of others and the idea of repaying their kindness, and at the same time focus on your cutting vegetables, you know, otherwise you might add a finger or two to whatever you're cooking. You know, it's not so safe. But if you think, you know, this is my motivation, and that's why I'm doing this action, then, you know, you pay attention to what you're doing. You have mindfulness and introspective awareness on cutting the vegetables, but it's being held by your bodhicitta motivation that you generated before you started doing that. Okay. So this is why at the Abbey we do all these short motivation prayers, you know, throughout the day, you know, one at the end of our stand-up meeting, you know, to create our motivation for working, you know, before lunch, after lunch, and so on, you know. If you go out to work in the forest, yes, it's something you say there. And then if you're surfing in the kitchen, there's another verse you say there. And so all of this helps bring bodhicitta up in our mind, and then we focus on whatever task we're doing. Okay, is that clear? Yeah. Okay, so I will just read the verse in which, again, that we went through last time, outlining the four objects of mind, the breathing, you know, with the four objects of mindfulness. So mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of phenomena. Okay. But the first verse is first concentrating on mindfulness of the body, and in particular, mindfulness of the breath. Okay, so how does a monastic abide contemplating the body as a body? Here a monastic sits down, having folded their legs crosswise, sets their body erect, and establishes mindfulness in front of them. So first, ever mindful, he breathes in, mindful, he breathes out. We usually even aren't aware of our breath, are we, during the day? Yeah, unless you're panting because you just walked up the hill or, you know. Okay, so mindful breathing in, mindful breathing out. Then the second phase is breathing in long. You understand, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. So that's the length of the breath, a long breath, a short breath. The third one, the second, yeah, that was the second one. Then the third one, oh no, I'm sorry. Another part of the second one is breathing in short. He understands I'm breathing short. So maybe you're taking a short breath just from your chest rather than a long breath where your diaphragm's moving and your belly's expanding. Okay, he understands I breathe in short or breathing out short. He understands I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing, this is the third phase now. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body of breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body of breath. And the fourth phase, he trains thus, I shall breathe in calming the body formation. He drains out thus, I shall breathe out calming the bodily formation. Okay, so that's just to help us review what we did last week. Yeah, and then we talked a little bit about, you know, most teachers recommend focusing on the upper lip and the nostrils. Some say focus on the abdomen. A lot of the teachers have various ways of teaching this, and everybody has their own way of kind of understanding it and adapting it to themselves. Yeah, because as I notice the questions we often ask about our own personal Dharma practice, my first response is, what is the context of what you're practicing? Yeah. You know, because breathing in and breathing out when you have a cold is going to be different than when your nostrils are clear. Okay. But if you just say, you know, talk about breathing in or out, I don't know which one it is. And you may not be clear yourself. Okay. So it's quite, you know, something as I, and then when I see, like this morning, we were trying with Geshe-la get some definitions and divisions of certain things and sequence of certain things. And again, I was thinking, you know, it all depends on the person who's asking and what the context of their practice is. We like to think that there's one thing that fits everybody. Yeah. One way to do the breathing meditation that is the best and only best for everybody. That doesn't exist. Yeah. Because we're different and we come to it differently and in different contexts, what's going on in our body that day, what we're thinking about. Okay? So just a thing to remember that when we talk about different stages of things or different types of things, there's not always a very clear line between one thing and another. Okay. And we have to get used to ambiguity. Yeah. Some people like one answer, that's it. But when it's ambiguous, they get a little, you know, unnerved. What is the best way to get from here to Newport? Okay, well, it depends where you want to go in Newport. It depends on the road conditions, if they're icy or not. It depends on how much gas you have in the tank. You know, there's so many things. So, you know, we often can't give one isolated answer to something, yeah, as much as we would like it, you know. Okay, so just keep that in mind. Okay, so I'm going to pick up from where we stopped last time. Halfway down, 341. While being mindful of the breath, don't forcefully control the breath. accept the breathing pattern that is present at any particular moment, knowing that the texture, tempo, and other aspects of your breath will naturally change as mindfulness deepens. As the mind becomes more concentrated, the breath will naturally become calmer and slower. When you start out watching the breath, one thing you may notice first is the tension in your body. Yeah, because you want to focus here, but your neck is stiff and your shoulders are like this and your legs are, you know, tense. And you have to first kind of relax them. And you realize, boy, I wonder how long I've had this tension and I haven't even noticed it. Yeah, and what's it doing to my body? Okay. So most commentaries recommend attending to the breath at the nostrils and upper lip. It seems that this point is more conducive for generating the nimitta or the sign, some small like sparkle thing that appears when your mind is getting more concentrated. Some meditation teachers recommend observing the breath at any point in the body where it can be experienced distinctly, such as the abdomen or the chest. Perhaps for some people, these points are more conducive for cultivating insight too. So that's why they start out focusing on that with serenity. You see how things depend? Yeah. So then the Buddha continued on giving instructions on mindfulness of the body to generate insight. Okay. So in this way, practicing the above, one, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, which means contemplating his own body, or contemplating the body as a body externally, in other words, other people's bodies. Or he abides contemplating the body as both internally, contemplating the body both internally and externally. Okay. Or two, or else he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, coming into being, every moment of the body coming into being. Or he abides contemplating the body in its nature of passing away. The body doesn't remain as what it is in the next moment. Okay. Or he contemplates, he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and passing away. So this is illustrated by the breath. Yeah. Breathing in, we say, we think arising. Exhaling, we think passing away. You know, but I said in other practices, in Tibetan Buddhism, the breath starts with breathing out, and then you breathe in. It's done for particular purposes. Okay. And then the third way is, or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. So just awareness, you have a body. What does that mean to have a body? Are you that body? Or are you not that body? Yeah. Is the body your possession? Or is it not your possession? Now, this is becomes quite interesting, especially when you consider how our body came into being, you know, from our parents' bodies, plus all the food we ate. And the food belongs to the farmers, or if you ate meat, the food, you know, It belongs to other sentient beings. Yeah. So what is, you know, what? How did this body arise? Yeah, and once it, you know, the body and mind came together, then what happens? Yeah. And how do they influence each other? Okay, or the fourth is, and he abides freely, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a monastic abides, contemplating the body as a body. Okay, so this four-part, this is His Holiness now. This four-part verse is a refrain following each of the meditations explained in mindfulness of the body. And there are many, there are other ones to come. We'll get into them. Okay, a similar verse follows the meditation on mindfulness of feelings, mind, and phenomena, substituting those words for body in the first verse. Okay, in the context of mindfulness on the breath, the first part is to observe the breath internally, so the breath in our own body. Yeah. And so is the breath outside at the beginning? Where is the breath? Before you breathe, where is the breath? Yeah. And when we say, I'm breathing, what do we mean? What is the breath? And when you're inhaling, yeah, oh, again, where is it and what is it? Does it exist separate from other things? Can you have breath that is separate from your body? Okay, if the breath depends on the body, what part of the body? Okay, so this leads you into understanding dependent arising. Okay, and how things are merely designated. There's air before we inhale. We don't call that air breath. It starts, when exactly does it start becoming breath? When you start to inhale, or when all of one inhalation is in your nostrils? Okay. Yeah, when does it become breath? And who called it breath? Yeah, it could have another name, couldn't it? When we exhale, sometimes we call it cough or snort or, you know, there's many other words. It's dependently designated. Yeah. And the air is, as it's inhaled, it's changing all the time, isn't it? It's not like all the molecules are lined up very nicely and they don't move at all as you inhale and exhale, except they're moving together. I don't think it's like that. Yeah. Okay. So in the context of mindfulness on the breath, the first part is to observe the breath internally, the breath in our own body. Externally, the breath in others' body. And internally and externally, the breath in our own and others' bodies alternately. How are you going to observe somebody else's breath? It's like, okay, tell me when you're inhale so I can pay attention, because I usually don't know when you're breathing or how you're breathing. Okay. So the emphasis here is on experiencing the breath in your own body. Sometimes focus on the fact that others are breathing. Yeah, this makes us aware that all of us are alike in breathing to stay alive. all of us are conditioned by our breath. And our breath itself is conditioned by other factors such as our lungs. And what I exhale can be what you inhale. Yeah, and what you exhale can be part of what I inhale. Mm-hmm. The second part is to contemplate that the breath has the nature of arising and passing away. This is done in two ways. First is by contemplating the causes and conditions of the body, and second, by contemplating our direct experience of arising and ceasing. So in terms of the causes and conditions, the body arises as a result of various factors. Now we think when I first read this, oh yeah, he's going to say sperm, egg, and food. He doesn't say that. He says ignorance, craving, and karma in previous lives being the chief cause of the body. Yeah. Do you look at your body and say this was created by ignorance, craving, and karma? Yeah, it's a good practice to have, you know, especially when your body is being very uncooperative and giving you some discomfort. You were created out of ignorance, craving, and karma. And that ignorance, craving, and karma were all mine. Okay? They came from this grasping at self. Okay, so they say, you know, be careful what you want, you may get it. Well, that's why we're here. We had ignorance, craving for another body, craving for existence, and then karma, which ripened and threw us into the present body. Hmm. Okay. In considering the breath specifically, the conditions are, I skipped something. Okay. So in terms of causes and conditions, the body arises as a result of various factors, ignorance, craving, and karma in previous lives being chief. The sperm, egg, and food are conditions producing the body in this life. Because the body is alive, breathing occurs. In considering the breath specifically, the conditions are the nostrils, trachea, lungs, diaphragm, and so forth. Yeah. The body ceases with the cessation of ignorance, craving, and karma. That's not going to be for a while. This body may cease when the brain and the heart and the breath cease, but the body taking a body isn't going to cease until we cease ignorance, craving, and karma. Yeah. So if you've forgotten about the 12 links of dependent arising, go back to the previous volume. Yeah. Okay. The body ceases with the cessation of ignorance, craving, and karma, or more immediately from the lack of food or breath, or because of illness or injury. Okay. Direct experience, that was the second way of contemplating the arising and passing of the body. Direct experience occurs when mindfulness is subtle and is extended throughout the entire body so that it is aware of the arising and ceasing of the breath as well as other processes in the body, such as digestion, circulation, and elimination. Yeah. Yet last time I asked, you know, we're not even aware of our breathing. You know, how aware are we of our digestion? Yeah. And the whole digestive system. Are we even aware of our heart beating and blood circulating? No. We are focused on, I want what I want when I want it. Yeah. Okay. So contemplating these, the breath and the other processes in the body, such as digestion, circulation, and elimination. So contemplating this leads to understanding subtle impermanence, that nothing remains in the next moment. Momentary change is the nature of functioning things. Yeah. So it isn't like we eat and then the food isn't changing, or there's no digestion until we push a switch and then it starts, and then we push another switch to make it stop. You know, as soon as the food enters our mouth, the whole digestion process begins, you know, with chewing it, adding saliva, swallowing it, you know, it goes down. And every moment, something different is happening to the food in our stomach. Yeah. I'm sure they must have in labs when you studied to be a nurse, like imitation stomachs that can show food, just, you know, getting digested. Yeah, you've seen that.
Yeah,
you can what? Oh, you can create poop with a machine. That's good. Okay, well, that's handy.
Yeah. They were trying to mimic the digestive tract and putting in the certain acids at different times and the absorptions and things like that. And yeah, it functioned, seemed to
wow.
be function like
huh.
like a digestive.
Okay. Tract. With more practice, this meditation brings direct insight into the impermanence of all physical and mental phenomena, which in turn leads to insight into the two other characteristics, dukkha, or the nature of being unsatisfactory, and no self, or selflessness. Okay, in the third part, by observing the breath, mindfulness establishes that there is a body, in case you forgot you have one. Okay, so here, mindfulness has been well developed. Deliberate effort is not necessary to be mindful of the in and out breaths or the long and short breaths. Instead, by focusing on the action of breathing, mindfulness is placed on the body as a whole. When we went through before what Vasubandhu was saying about breathing meditation, he was saying, there's also the thing, to imagine that your breath is like a thread and going down and throughout your whole body and then coming up and going out. Yeah. So many different ways to observe the breath. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this was mindfulness is placed on the body as a whole while you're breathing. As soon as mindfulness of the body is established, the awareness of the arising and ceasing of its components arises easily. Observing this, the understanding arises that the body and breath are impersonal phenomena. There is no self in them, and this leads to insight knowledge. Okay. So, you're observing the arising and ceasing of the components of the body. Yeah. So you're going to have to probably fix on one part of the body and arising, it's watching its arising and ceasing. Yeah. And we can't, when we start, see the directly the subtle impermanence of the body. You really need to have shamatha, serenity, for that. Yeah. But you can get a sense that different parts of your body are changing. You know, when your stomach is growling, clearly it's changing. Okay. So here it is evident. Oh, let me go back. So observing that, then you can see, watching all the different parts of the body arise and cease. Is there a person in any of those parts of the body? Yeah? Are you your brain? We always say, I'm thinking as if there's the self is in here. Are you your brain? Yeah? Some people think they're their brain. And then, the chemical, electrical things going on in the neurons, that's experience. But I think they think that because they don't look at their own experience. Yeah. Because our life experience, when you're happy, when you're angry, whatever you're feeling, that is not a bunch of chemical, electrical things. Yeah, you could put a neuron out there and, get the right chemicals going, the happy chemicals. Yeah. Does that neuron feel happy? Yeah. I don't think so. Yeah. So you go through the whole body, looking for who you are. And we feel, some people feel like they're up here. Yeah. Some people feel like they're in here in the center of the chest, at the heart chakra. Yeah. Or sometimes you think up here and you think you feel here. So then I guess your self goes back and forth between the brain and the center of your chest. But what in the center of your chest are you? If you feel I, yeah? Are you your sternum? Maybe some rib? Yeah? What's under that? There's tissue, lungs. Yeah? You found your eye in there? No?
But in terms of moving the self from the brain to somewhere else, there was one story of one of our community members who had a lung transplant. And after she had it, she started craving chocolate ice cream all the time. And she couldn't figure out why until she called
it a lung transplant. And she craved chocolate ice cream.
She started craving chocolate ice cream constantly. And she called the parents of the 19-year-old girl who'd died and given her lungs. And she used to hide chocolate ice cream all the time in her freezer. And then I met another man on alms round who'd had a heart transplant and started cooking tamales for his whole neighborhood. And he learned that the donor had been known as the tamale mother and just made tamales for everyone around her. So just to say, yeah, I thought those were nice little things about us not being in the brain.
Okay. No, but then if the self, if you're here, then you had that heart transplant, then there's going to be two yous here. There's you and there's going to be the lady, who made the tamales. Yeah. And when you breathe in, you're going to be, breathing in chocolate. Yeah. And so there's going to be multiple selves in the body. And all of them are you. So there's multiple yous. Cuckoo. Ready to see so. Yeah.
Thank you. So, Venerable, I kind of have a question. I feel, well, I'm always confused.
Yeah.
How can you, like, if my present existence is dependent upon my previous incarnation, mm-hmm. at what point can you really truly say you stop being that? Even though I'm not Fido, I needed to be Fido to be Rashika. You know, so it's like, can you ever say that something has arisen or see, you know, it doesn't seem like that's identifiable.
Yes. Can you mark the exact moment that that life begins or the test occurs? Can you? You know what I loved about math class? I have a lot of ways of applying what I learned in math class to certain Dharma things. You know, if you shoot an arrow from here to here, yeah, first the arrow goes halfway, then it goes another halfway, then it goes another halfway, and it keeps on going halfways. So how can it hit that? Because whatever small distance there is, yeah, it only goes halfway. And there's infinite halfways, aren't there? Yeah. So when you look for things, exactly what are they? Yeah, this is what you run into. Yeah. And this is why we say that they lack their own inherent nature, because when you look for what exactly they are or when exactly they arose, you cannot put your finger on it.
I don't know when it stopped, when it started, if it continued, but it's...
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so then we see that we just kind of designate, watch that word, designate when something starts and stops. So that, you know, especially in legal things, okay, you have to have a definition, you know, and a line when something happens. But even that line, it's totally made up and it's totally inaccurate. Yeah. Because when can you point to the exact moment when somebody died? You know? It's when the subtlest mind leaves the body. So when is that? Just when it opens here, when it goes out here? Yeah, okay. I'll give you another example of how ambiguous our language could be. And this is why when we talk about conventional truths, you know, my little slogan is conventional truths are messy because they exist just through our conception and our giving names and definitions to things that we kind of all agree upon. But many of our arguments occur because we don't agree on exactly that definition or exactly what something was. Okay, so the example I like to tell is when I was in Israel leading a kibbutz, leading a retreat at a kibbutz. Yeah, no, I don't want to lead a kibbutz. No, thank you. Anyway, so the kibbutz was right on the border with Jordan. It was in the Negev desert. Okay, so there was, let's say, Israel on this side. There was a fence, yeah, one of the, you know, metal fences that little, yeah, like the fences we have. Then there was a space with some sand, and then there was another fence. Okay. So somehow that the first fence must be in Israel, the second fence must be in Jordan. And the sand in between was no man's land. So who did it belong to? And then I was standing there thinking of that, and the wind started to blow, and some of the sand that was Israel blew over the two fences and became part of Jordan. Yeah? So is Israel going to say, Jordan, you stole my territory? Yeah. Give me back my sand. Or maybe the wind was blowing the other way, and it flew from Jordan back to Israel. And then Jordan's saying, Israel, you know, you're stealing my country, my soil. Yeah. Whose sand was it? Can you decide? Can the sand be both? At any particular moment, you might say it's Israel or it's Jordan. But whose sand is it? Yeah. So when we quarrel with people, it's always easier. He started it. Isn't it? Yeah, me? I never start. The quarrel started. You started it. You got upset about something. Me? I never get upset about stuff, or if I get upset, it's your fault. Right? Okay, so the point here is we give names to things, and then we think that by giving it a name, it has some existence from its own side, something that makes it the definition that we gave to that name. Yeah. And we could easily change the name. Yeah. It's quite interesting, but we get very attached to words. Very attached. And the whole legal system is basically, yeah, especially if you have a criminal trial, you're arguing over two words. Are they innocent or are they guilty? Which word are we going to apply to that person? And so that's what the whole trial is. And what you spend so much money on hiring a lawyer and the judicial system, you know, establishing courtyards and a courthouses. I suppose they have a yard. but, you know, we fight over the words because we think that each word has, you know, some inherent meaning, that and that whatever meaning I give to it must be the correct meaning. And then we wind up quarreling over the meaning. Yeah. Did that person kill somebody deliberately or accidentally? Yeah. How do you determine that? Was the intention deliberate? Or did it just pop in their mind accidentally? Yeah. Anyway, this is why I say conventional truths are messy. And why so much when you ask a question, you know, the answer could start of, it depends. Or what is the context? And even then, you can't pinpoint things exactly. It's like we look at Yeah, this painting over here of Shantideva. At what moment did the painting begin? What was the beginning of the painting?
There's no beginning.
There's no beginning? So that means we've had the painting forever? Yeah? It existed before somebody called it a painting? Or before it had paint on it? Yeah? Does it start with the intention to paint? Does it start with a canvas? Does it start with paint? You know, when we start analyzing things, we come up with dependency, always dependency, you know, and the inability to draw nice, distinct lines. And one of our problems as, you know, as human beings is we want nice, distinct lines. We do not like ambiguity at all. Okay. So this class starts at 7 Pacific time. 6 It starts at 6 Pacific time, 7 Mountain time. So it does start at 7. And it starts at 8 on Central time and 9 at Eastern time. So what time does it start? And when exactly is 7 o'clock, according to which clock? Well, you get one of those ones that line up with some satellite. But you know what? Different manufacturers of clocks line up with different satellites. And when do you go from mountain time to Pacific time? What point does the satellite have to be and do you have to be? Because if you're going to something in Missoula, but your clock is Pacific time, yeah, you're going to be late. But we like nice, neat, tidy things, don't we? It makes us feel very secure. Yeah. Ambiguity gives us the heebie-jeebies, you know? We don't like anything that's insecure, you know, that anything that is maybe this or maybe that or depends on this or that. But everything's like that, isn't it? Yeah. I'm in a good mood. I'm in a bad mood. How does that influence your breath? Do you breathe the same when you're in a good mood as when you're in the bad mood? Do you notice what mood you're in before you start breathing? Yeah. Or even you're doing the breathing meditation, do you notice what, you know, how your mood is when you start, and how your mood influences the breath, and how the breath influences your mood. I mean, the whole point of all of this when we start looking is that just everything exists in relationship to everything else and is influencing everything else in one way or another. And our mind, which creates these lines and definitions, is a big element in creating whatever it is around us. Yeah. I love getting off on that tangent. Yeah, because it's so true, you know, and how uncomfortable I feel confused in my life. I want to know what I'm doing. What do you mean, what you're doing? What are you doing? Yeah? What kind of doing do you want to know? Yeah? Doing meaning what you're thinking? Doing mean your meaning your place in this, you know, community of people called the world, you know? Yeah? As we can't draw nice, neat lines. So confusion is just the name of the game in many cases. And we just make some categories and names, and then we feel much more relaxed. Yeah. It starts at 7 o'clock. Pronto, especially if you're German. Yeah? But who's 7 o'clock? According to whose watch? Yeah. And 7:01, meaning 7 o'clock with 1 second, 7 o'clock with 2 seconds. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. What are we going to pinpoint? Okay. Now I gotta find my place. Okay, I will designate a place. Okay. Yeah, we're on top of page 343. Here it is evident that the mindfulness meditation is not simply bare attention to what thoughts or perceptions pass through the mind. Okay? This is... you know, what they call secular mindfulness is mindfulness, which is just bare attention. What's going through my body? What's going through my mind? You can tell from what we've discussed so far, this is much more in depth than noticing that. Yeah, this is really involving our analytical wisdom. Mm-hmm. The Buddha prescribed particular objects to focus on, to study, to become familiar with, and to examine. We are to understand specific characteristics of these objects, such as their impermanent nature. Such mindfulness leads us to realizations. Okay, so impermanence, in one way, is a specific characteristic. Because it's different from being dukkha by nature, yeah, unsatisfactory by nature. But in another way, when we talk about general characteristics of the four objects of mindfulness, they all have the same general characteristic of being impermanent. And their specific characteristic, yeah, for example, with the body, specific characteristics would be it's made of atoms and molecules. So even the word general and specific have different meanings in different contexts. Okay, so the fourth part describes the result of meditating as outlined above. A practitioner is free from clinging to things of this world. Their mind is free from the tumult caused by attachment and animosity regarding sense objects. Free of attachment and animosity caused by ideas presented in the media, or our friends' approval or disapproval or our reputation. So we can have tumult and attachment and confusion about many different things. So although this is not yet the ultimate goal of nirvana, it is a step in that direction that brings more internal peace. And we begin to see that peace starts in our mind, okay? We cannot legislate peace. Yeah. We can create laws that help may help some people be peaceful, but of course people are going to break those laws. But peace itself, creating it, starts with our own individual mind. Yeah. So we can be a creator of peace or a creator of war. Our choice. 16 special ascendant practices associated with the breath are explained in the Sutra on the Mindfulness of Breathing, the Anapanasati Sutta. So there are 16 steps or aspects in that sutta of mindfulness of the breath. The first four have to do with mindfulness of the body. While breathing in and out, one contemplates first the long in and out breath, two, the short in and out breath, three, experiencing the whole body, and four, calming the body formation. That's what we just went through. The second four of the 16 corresponds to mindfulness of feelings. So while breathing in and out, one contemplates experiencing joy, experiencing bliss, experiencing the mental formation of feeling and discrimination, and calming the mental formation. The third set of four regards mindfulness of the mind. So this is what you're doing while you're breathing in and out. One contemplates first experiencing the mind, second, gladdening the mind, third, concentrating the mind, and fourth, liberating the mind. Okay, and then the fourth set are mindfulness phenomena. So while breathing in and out, one contemplates impermanence, fading away or ceasing. 15, the third in this fourth set, observing cessation, and then last, contemplating relinquishment. Okay, so those all have much more explanation to them that we're not getting into here. But on page 429, it goes through that again. Yeah, so we'll cycle through this. Okay. So next is mindfulness of the four postures. So maintaining mindfulness with the four postures of the body, walking, sitting, standing, and lying down, is taught at the beginning and is practiced throughout our training. Whatever activity we do, sweeping, eating, drinking, defecating, talking, we train in mindfulness and introspective awareness. And then it says, please refer back to the discussion in chapter 11. So if we go back to that, I think that's start with, let's say, page 312, introspective awareness. Remember, we went through all different kinds and situations of introspective awareness. So that's referring back to that. Again, I won't go through it now because we did it before, but you can go back and refer yourself. Okay. So in brief, know what you are doing when you are doing it. Okay. Now, as I age, and I walk into a room and say, why did I come in here? I know it was because there was something in that room that I wanted, but I can't remember what it was. It's usually my mala, okay? It's usually my mala, sometimes my hat. And I can't remember where I put it down. Yeah. Now, is the problem that I'm not aware of where I put it down? Or is the problem that I was aware, but by the time I get in the room, I can't remember it? Yeah. And what does being aware where I put my mala down? Do I have to say the words, I'm putting my mala down? Or do I have to think I'm putting my mala down and then say on the table and then specifying which table? Because there's many tables in the room. Yeah. So it's an interesting thing, you know. Or are we just totally spaced out and not even realizing that we're putting our mala down? But how can you not have awareness of putting your mala down when there has to be an intention for your arm to move? And an intention is something that happens in the mind. So are we not aware of our own intentions? Sometimes it seems that way. Yeah, like you're in the middle of saying something really nasty and you say, why am I saying that? Shut up. And you can't stop yourself from speaking. Did you have the intention to say that? Yeah. Okay, so I'm doing the thing I love so much, asking all these kind of, but this was how I was trained, yeah. Especially Geshe Sonam Rinchen, when he would teach things like this, he would ask us those questions, and by the end of the class, our heads were spinning, you know? He got us really good and confused. Yeah. But that's what makes you think. Yeah. Okay, let me continue here. Okay. If I can remember where I stopped. Okay. Okay. In brief, know what you are doing when you are doing it. Be aware of not only the body's movement, but also how it is moving. Is the body moving quickly, slowly, gently, or with agitation? Are you moving noisily, making a fuss, tripping over your feet? Yeah. Or walking smoothly? Yeah. So instead of letting the mind go here and there, following whatever thought enters it, be fully present with the body, not thinking about the past or future. But I'm one of those people who likes to know what I'm doing in the next moment. If I'm going somewhere, I want to know why I'm going there. So don't I have to think about what I'm going to do when I go there in order to go there? So aren't I thinking about the future? Mindfulness of the four postures supplements other mindfulness practices in that it is done during the break time between formal meditation sessions. In the forest tradition of Southeast Asia, a meditator does retreat in a hut called a kuti with a nearby stretch of smooth ground or flat stones about 30 steps long for walking meditation. Sometimes a bench is placed on the other end so that the meditator can do walking meditation for some time and then sit for formal meditation. Yeah. Yeah. If you're doing walking meditation at the Abbey, you're going to either be walking on concrete, very unlikely, or walking on gravel, very likely. Yeah. To begin walking meditation, be mindful of the right foot and the left foot stepping. Okay, upon reaching the end of the walkway, pause and be mindful of standing. then turn slowly and pause, being aware of those motions, and then begin to walk again, being aware of the right foot and the left foot moving. Okay. Now, how we do this is going to depend, I think, a little bit on the individual. For me, when I do exactly those instructions, it is too boring. I can't do it for very long, you know. So I need to do that whole mindfulness of what is a step? When does the step begin? Yeah. Who is the person stepping? Nagarjuna, in chapter 2 of his treatise on the middle way, he talks about coming and going. It sounds easy. You know when you're coming. You know when you're going. And he starts dissecting it. Okay, because you have the goer, the going, and then the space gone over. And he gets you really good and confused. Yeah. What is the space gone over? And you think, oh, it's the space that my foot is over. So when, you know, are you choosing just one space and that's the space gone over? You know, oh, no, it's this whole space. Well, no, that has different steps. Well, what about the step? What is a step? Where is it going over? Well, are you talking about where the space below your heel or the space below your toes or the space below the ball of your foot? Yeah, what's the space gone over? And if you're going to say, I'm the goer, are you the goer when you lift your foot, when the foot's going forward, and when you put your foot down? And what about if you're going from here to there? What about in the middle? If you pause, are you still a goer? And to be a goer, don't you have to have gone before so that you are now a goer? How can you say, I'm the goer, if you didn't go? Yeah. But if you did go, you're no longer a goer. So when do you become a goer? Yeah. So that kind of analysis keeps me awake and on my feet, you know, because to me it's very interesting. Yeah, I have to really think, yeah, like, what's going on here? And of course, that turns into thinking about impermanence and thinking about emptiness. But first you get very confused because we like nice, neat definitions and lines. Okay. So to begin walking meditation, be mindful of the right foot and the left foot stepping. Upon reaching the end of the walkway, pause and be mindful of standing. Then turn slowly and pause, being aware of those motions, and begin to walk again. So I guess you weren't a walker when you came this way, because you have to begin to walk again, then you are no longer a walker. Okay, so begin walking again, being aware of the right foot and the left foot moving. To make mindfulness subtler, divide each step into three phases, lifting the foot, pushing it forward, placing it down, and be mindful of each place, phase. Okay, then what keeps me interested, when does it start to be lifting? When does it go between lifting and pushing? And when does pushing, you know, your leg forward stop and lowering it starts? Okay. An intention to lift, push, and place the foot precedes each movement. Become aware of these as well. Do you have, and then as you subdivide it, do you have a different intention for every centimeter that your foot moves? Or is it one intention? And does one intention have parts? And if it has parts, is it the same intention? Okay. Our mindfulness rests on six phases: intention to lift and lifting, intention to push forward, pushing, intention to place and placing. So those six, yeah. After becoming proficient in being mindful of each of these phases, be mindful of ever smaller moments of intention and movement of the feet. But doesn't your leg lift too? Shouldn't you be mindful of that? And where does your leg stop and your foot start? Well, there's an ankle between. So which part does the ankle belong to? When strong mindfulness is developed, perceiving the arising and ceasing of hundreds of tiny intentions and hundreds of tiny actions in each step becomes possible. So we're going to stop there before we figure out at what moment the class stops. And we're going to have time for a couple of questions. Okay. So, Rishika, you want to start?
I'm sorry. I just have to say, this sounds like a really bad M. Night Shyamalan movie where we're going to realize we're all ghosts at the end. It's just, it's like, what? Where did this come from? It's just so many. But I guess my question was, it sounds like we have like almost like an uncountable like number of moments of mind rising simultaneous, and the goal is to be aware of all of them. Is that right?
Yep.
Oh,
that's not- Oh, I like that. Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. Okay. Because any moment something is arising, because something is arising, it's also simultaneously abiding because it's a continuation of what came before. And it's also simultaneously ceasing because it's different than what happened. So arising, abiding, and ceasing all occur at the same time. Is that possible? Well, it's different ways of looking at something. There's different ways of looking at arising, abiding, and ceasing. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Venerable, when you were talking about the way we can, like, thinking when we're doing the walking meditation, and I was... just going back a little bit on the second one of the four correspond to mindfulness of feeling. And the A1, it says calming the mental formation.
Yeah.
So
the mental formations refers to your body. Okay. So calming by calming the body, the feelings in the body change.
Yeah, but if you're thinking and describing and reflecting on when the steps begins and ceases and et cetera, et cetera. Those are mental formations.
Yes, yes.
So when it becomes calming, the mental formations?
That's a good question. Yeah. What is calming it? Does it have to be 100% calm to be calm, to be calming it? Like, isn't calming your mind or calming your body there's many moments in that, and it's very different. Each moment is different. Because you start to calm, yeah, and then you get calmer, and you know, each moment is different. So we give the name calming the mental formations to that whole thing. Yeah, and then when is the mind really calm? Yeah, if you're, can you have a calm mind and think? Does being calm mean you stop thinking? Is stopping thinking the purpose of meditation? In which case, I think cows, that's why we call cows holy cows, because they don't think a lot. But cows actually think a lot. They've got to know where they are, where they're going, what the food is. Yeah. You had a question?
This paragraph on page 342 is driving me crazy.
342. Okay.
It starts off with direct experience occurs.
Uh-huh.
And mindfulness is subtle. So wait a minute. How did we get there? That's my first question.
You practice mindfulness when it, where you are, and subtly, over time, it gets subtle. Mm-hmm. But, and when it stops going from gross to subtle, yeah. Well, I think, you know, how are we going to measure that? Yeah. What is gross mindfulness? What is subtle mindfulness? What's the line between them? How many in-between stages are there? Yeah. So it's a process. Yeah, it's a process. And it's very difficult to, you know, isolate individual moments of it. Or to say, when did the calming start? When does it stop? Okay, so you just do that. Okay, this will be the last question. Yeah, you have to speak loudly into the mic.
Hello. Thank you, Venerable. So from my understanding of a calm mind, it feels like more like a unified mind. It's not being pulled in different directions and scattered. It's very absorbed, and it feels whole.
Yeah.
And then you're able to more clearly
and
see.
And then what?
You're able to more clearly see the citta. Mm-hmm. But even then, it's changing. And I've always thought that, oh, I should be stabilizing that. But mm-hmm. maybe should I be observing the changing and observing impermanence?
Well, it depends on what you're focusing on, okay? If you're focusing on the sensation, yeah, of calm, and like, yeah, how do I know my mind is calm? What does calm feel like? Yeah. Or are you focusing on the, you know, oh, my mind's calm, but it's changing every moment. Are the moments changing? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it can almost be visual too, like with the light. And sometimes it's stable and a lot of times it's changing.
Yeah. Yeah, that may be how you know if your mind's getting calm. Yeah. But it could also depend on the room you're sitting in, whether there's light in it. Yeah. And what does a calm mind really feel like? Do you have to cease all thoughts and just become blah, 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 you know? No. You know, you can calmly investigate something. Yeah. I mean, because when we're developing insight, we have to investigate. And we need a calm mind. Okay. So I know that other people have more questions, but I'm drawing the line. Yeah, and we'll close now. Okay, so I'll dedicate the merit.